2020-1921, Zaxcon versus Electrosonics. Obviously, the issues are similar, if not the same. We don't necessarily need to hear repetition, but the time is yours, and to the extent you didn't quite have enough time, you're entitled to use your time as you see fit. Mr. Greenspoon.
Yes, thank you again, Your Honor, and good morning again, Your Honors. May it please the Court. In this companion appeal, I'd like to focus on different board errors from what we find in the 1350 case. And here we have two patents, the 902 patent and the 814 patent. These, just for procedural framework, these were consolidated appeals at this court from two final written decisions. Judges, in one regard, the nexus error is more plain than in the other appeal, because now the board overlooked the claimed concepts in the objective evidence of time code management. Those are express call-outs in the bullet points that Mr. Bell says that we should be paying such close attention to. So that's express linkage between text in the award materials and novel claim combinations. And the board's error, and again on the original claims, the board's error was to deprive Zaxcom of its nexus finding for that. That's all I think I want to say on nexus for this appeal, because we've said quite a bit already. I'd like to move on and focus differently in this appeal.
Mr. Greenson, can I just ask one question? Mr. Bell, at the very conclusion of the previous argument, made a point about how, I'm going to translate this, that there was actually an anticipation showing, so secondary considerations are legally immaterial, so it doesn't really matter on those, and the board on the substitute claims made a decision effectively based on the secondary considerations, which should have been legally immaterial. Is that same point at issue in the current appeal?
You would have to ask Mr. Bell, but in this appeal, there is the same kind of lineup of one claim anticipated, perhaps, or one claim set anticipated, and other claims rendered obvious under the original.
Well, if it's here, before you move off of obvious, secondary considerations, what's your answer to the point?
Well, the claims held invalid for obviousness have extra elements that even the board was convinced meant that they were not anticipated. So we're now straight into the middle of why we have objective evidence in the first place in our case law, is to prevent the hindsight bias from seemingly simple sounding inventions being held invalid when they're actually groundbreaking. And
So are you saying that all of the claims that are currently at issue were held and invalid only under 103, none of them under 102?
Not correct. The claim 12 in each of these appeals, the companion appeals, was held anticipated. So in this appeal, when I focus on the obviousness mistakes, if you will, I'm focusing on claim 1 and claim 7 of the 902 patent in this appeal, and claim 1 of the 814 patent also in this appeal. And then in the other appeal from earlier today, claim 1 of the 307 patent. So it's a motley mix. We do have to pay attention to that. I agree with that. But anyway, the 1902.
I'm sorry for harping on this, but I'm just trying to figure out. Are you agreeing that at least one or more of the substitute claims, both here and in the previous case, were incorrectly upheld?
No. I was saying that. I'll be very precise. I'll concede that if the claim construction is not changed by this court, then the anticipation holdings in the 307 patent case from earlier today should be upheld. And I'm going to get into a technical argument showing that there is a misperception of what's in the prior art for the appeal we're arguing now. So I'm arguing against anticipation and obviousness in the upcoming remarks for this appeal. I know it's spotted. I understand that. So claim 7 and of 902 and claim 1 of 814 each require two things that the prior art combination lacked. And these were a particular time sync architecture, which is a master time code generator controlling a local audio device's local generator, and also the wearability that the claims require. And I'll start with the master time code generator, because the board located this feature in a reference called Wu, but taking Wu for all it teaches, it's just, Your Honors, it's just not there. There was no substantial evidence in the record for the board to find this element in Wu. The proof of this is Appendix 1556, the reference itself, starting column 7, line 27, where there are ports going into an audio device, but inside the audio device, there's no local timecode generator at all. It just thoughtlessly takes the codes created externally in a GPS unit. That's it. That's not what Zaxcom's patents are about, which require a fully operable local timecode generator in the audio device. And we briefed this, that serves a purpose, which is if the master sync is unavailable, the local can continue to run freely to keep stamping the audio. Now, there is a part of Wu that sends master codes to a local generator. That's a thin disclosure in Wu in the same place I just mentioned. But what you can see is that this part of Wu is not about audio devices. It is for a camera. So this part of Wu sends the generated time codes to a camera, not to a local audio device with its own local time code generator receiving master codes. So let's turn to the wearable limitation. And Your Honors, if you agree with Zaxcom about Wu, as I just argued, you don't have to reach wearable. And here the focus is on Strub. Strub is not wearable. It just is not in the context of the intrinsic record. And this should be an easy call for the court based on the prosecution history. There's
like
a device.
It looks like what Strub is wearing is wearable.
In a general layperson sense, absolutely. I agree. I don't contend otherwise. But that's why we look to the patent intrinsic record, which is communicated as its own public notice beacon to members of the interested public. And in this case, that would be technologists in the field of performance audio and performance audio recording. So
is this a claim construction argument you're making, or that even under the verbal formulation adopted by the board as the claim construction, it's simply unreasonable to find that the Strub backpack-like thing is wearable?
I wouldn't mind prevailing if it's considered a factual reading instead of a claim construction, but I think more fairly it's a claim construction argument. The reason why you could construe it as a factual reading is because we have expert testimony in the record where Electrosonics experts said that a backpack is not wearable in this context. That's a fact. And Strub discloses backpacks with straps, headband, et cetera. So there's a device called the Niagara 5 that prompted the original wearable term to enter the claims in the first place. And adding the wearable term to the claims overcame the prior art, overcame the Niagara 5. And the examiner explicitly agreed. So that set the boundary condition for the public notice function of the intrinsic record. This told the public that anything bigger than Niagara 5 cannot be wearable in the context of this art, this industry, this patent specification, and these claims. And there is no size dispute about Strub. It is bigger by far than Niagara 5. So while in a sense, Judge Lurie, as you observed, you know, Strub does get strapped to the body using a backpack, but it's not wearable in the intrinsic record sense. And we briefed how Electrozone expert confirmed that a hiking backpack is not wearable in this sense because the context is performer body packs. And look at me on this video, Your Honors. I mean, if I were wearing a backpack with my wireless audio equipment, you would see it. Your Honors would easily conclude I could not perform in a TV show or a film.
I mean, I'm not sure we would see the Strub backpack, which is some kind of low slung and smallish as backpacks go.
In this art, Your Honor, that's gigantic. I mean, there's no way a performer could enter every scene wearing the Strub backpack, even if you consider it a small backpack. In this art, that would just be absolutely anathema, absolutely forbidden. We just don't do that. We have tiny, unobtrusive body packs. That's what the art is all about. So wearability comes down to respect for the intrinsic record, respect for Electro's expert admissions. Strub is not wearable, and that's the second reason why the combination should not have led to obviousness. So the combination lacks the claim limitation. Again, this is an argument that doesn't directly address anticipation, I believe, although let me put a pin in that because I might have to check something. But the combination lacks the claim limitations. The objective evidence was strong, and the court should reverse the board. And I'd like to reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Thank you. We will do that. Mr. Bell.
Thank you, Your Honors. I'll start with addressing two things. First of all, counsel just stated that the original claims in the 307 case did not include wearable. They did. Saxtown chose not to appeal that issue in the first case. It only chose to appeal that issue in later cases. Second, you heard...
Can I just ask on that? I know that the government makes an issue preclusion argument. You did not make that. You invoked 315E, which would seem quite not applicable because it's not the same claim.
Well, the claim element is the same. It's
315E is not about claim elements. It's about the claim, different claims here.
I understand your position, Your Honor.
Okay.
So first on wearability, you heard Mr. Greenspoon talk repeatedly about how Zaxxon's product is a body pack. There was also claims here to a body pack that they did not appeal. And those were mapped to figure 9 of the Strub reference, which is not a backpack. It is a most long belt pack that includes all of the components. On the nexus issue, they are largely the same here, except for two things. I think it's very important to note Mr. Greenspoon's focus on time code and how essential that was to Zaxxon's invention. Because now we're talking about another set of claims where they're saying everything is about time code, right? That is what makes the invention work. It's time code. They're saying that that is the essential feature, and that is in two of the claims here, claim 7 of the 902 and claim 1 of the 814. But it is not in the claims of the 307, and it's not in claim 12 of the 902 patent. So what they're telling you is the essential feature, and what makes this great is not in all of their claims. And the problem for them, particularly with regards to the local time code generator, is the board found that that was disclosed by Strub. So when we look again at what they are mapping, if you go to their appendix site, APPX 541, what they said is coextensive. The product that they mapped is the local audio device. They didn't map the master time code generator. They didn't map the remote recorder. They mapped just the elements of the local audio device. And all of those features are in Strub for the claims that were found and anticipated. The only thing that was missing from Strub in the claims that were not found and anticipated was the fact that it required an audio input port, something that even Zaxxon does not dispute would be obvious to have an audio input port between the microphone and the body pack or belt pack. Unless your honors have any further questions, I'll reserve the remainder of my time.
Can I just bring up this question? You ended your previous argument by saying something about how secondary considerations are immaterial to something or other because that something or other is really anticipated. Is there such a point here? And I don't really understand the scope of the point. Is this about the upheld substitute claims?
Yes, Your Honor. I think the key issue is that Zaxxon has argued in its original patent owner response, their arguments below were that claim 12 of the 307 patent and claim 12 of the 920 patent, which were found to be anticipated by the board, were within the scope of what had industry praise. Their expert argued that all of the originally issued claims had industry praise. And if the claims that are anticipated were commensurate in scope with the industry praise, then we have this clear finding that what the industry praised was all in the prior art. So it makes no sense that we would now look at other claims that add other features, and that those two, under the same evidence of praise, would therefore be obvious when you added something that's not really the core of their invention, something like the replacing element, which even their own expert admitted was known, so long as you had the backup. And the concept of the backup all shows up in the local audio device. And to the same extent as in their product and in the claims, it's also in Strub.
And just one thing. I don't recall that you have disputed that the placing language is limited to replacement because of defective transmission, i.e. dropout, even though that word by itself, replacing, would seem to be independent of the reason you're doing the replacing.
Yes, Your Honor. We did not argue. Replacing means replacing. It does not encompass all forms of dropout repair. There could be mixing. There could be blending. There's all different ways of doing it. This is just one specific way that they added to get around scrub, because scrub already discloses blending, so they had to go that narrow.
Ms. Silfen.
Thank you, Your Honor. I don't want to replow old ground, just to pick up on the point about industry praise for the original claims, that was all under Zaxcom's understanding of the original claims or claim construction of the original claims, where they were reading those original claims to be as narrow as the board is reading the amended claims, right? So the original claims, the arguments about industry praise apply to the amended claims in the same way, because the reading of those claims was effectively the same. They were reading the original claims as if they were as narrow as the amended claims. So I just wanted to, I don't know if that clarifies anything or makes it worse, but anyway, that was just something I wanted to mention. And then to go back to a point, I think it was from the previous argument, but I just wanted to note, Judge Toronto, you asked about whether the weighing of secondary considerations is an issue of law or fact. KSR says that the obviousness question is a question of law with underlying factual determinations, including secondary considerations. So secondary considerations overall is a question of fact. I think it's true that there is a legal sort of kernel in there of this presumption and burden shifting analysis, but the ultimate question on secondary considerations is one of fact.
My question is, let's assume there's something of non-zero weight under this broad heading of secondary considerations, which cover a lot of ground. The weighing of that something against the art-based analysis, often called prima facie, is a legal analysis. I'm sure we have said that. I'm pretty sure the Supreme Court has said that, right?
I don't recall seeing that, but I could imagine that that's true, because it's, again, a question of sort of whose burden you're putting who has the burden in a given situation.
If that were not true, how would it be true that obviousness is a question of law?
Well, it's phrased as a question of law with underlying factual determinations. And then the factual determinations include secondary considerations, include what the prior art says, include a bunch of subsidiary questions. And then the ultimate question of, like, I guess it's similar to what you're saying, how you weigh all of those things and decide whether the invention is obvious is a question of law.
Okay.
I'm happy to answer any questions. That's all I had to affirmatively say.
This one thing which I think I'm getting close to clear, but I'm not clear enough, and that's this point which I understood Mr. Bell initially to make, that some aspect of the board's upholding of substitute claims was really about anticipation and should therefore never have even considered as to those claims, the anticipated ones, any secondary considerations. I thought later maybe I heard him say, no, he's just making a point about the scope of the praise analysis or something. Can you enlighten me on this?
I think it's the latter. So there's anticipation with respect to the original claims. There is no anticipation argument anywhere with respect to the substitute claim.
Okay, I think that fully answers my question. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Silfen. Mr. Greenspoon has some time left.
Thank you, Judge. So just three quick points. I agree with Ms. Silfen and the director that the assigned weight is a subsidiary fact. It's a question of fact that's part of the obviousness rubric. So when the board found that the objective evidence was quote unquote strong, that's the board's words, that's a factual finding reviewed for substantial evidence. What the board does with that conclusion can be looked at de novo on appeal for the final conclusion of obviousness, because what you do with that conclusion about the characterization of the objective evidence, what you do with it later is part of the legal question of the final determination of obviousness. I hope that helps. So very quickly, what we heard from Mr. Bell about time code features, he contends that all those features were found in Strub by the board. We briefed this thoroughly. That's not actually an accurate characterization of what the board did. The board reported Mr. Bell's argument that these features were found in Strub, then proceeded not to make those findings, but instead went, and there's a particular footnote that shows this, they went expressly to Wu to look for that claim element, because in fact, that was really the thrust of their petition. And so the factual findings, which we are appealing as to the original claims, particular ones, the factual finding was the presence in Wu of the master time code generator architecture, because the board made no findings that Strub had anything remotely to deal with that claim limitation. So finally, Judge Toronto, I hope this is the final word to clarify the anticipation versus obviousness confusion. And this is
no, I believe I'm satisfied right now. So
okay. Well, I need to clarify where I put a pin in it. I just went back to confirm the claim 12 in each of the appeals that we're appealing. When you look for claim 12, all you have to know is we're not appealing anything about nexus or obviousness. Those claims were found anticipated in both appeals, 12 of 307 and 12 of 902.
On the original claims.
The original claims. Okay. So our appeal is solely on claim construction, and we essentially it's the same claim construction appeal in both cases for those respective claims, and so obviousness is not a question there. And thank you, Your Honors. I see I'm over my time. We would respectfully ask for reversal.
Thank you, Mr. Greenspoon. Mr. Bell, you had a little time left on the cross appeal. Did I hear anything on the cross appeal that you need to respond to or entitled to?
So the one thing on the cross appeal is Ms. Hilton stated that the essentially as patent owners, the arguments were that the same between the original claims and the amended claims on these two patents. I will note that in this case, original claim one of the 814 patent and original claim seven and the 902 patents, those did not include the combining or the replacing elements that are at issue in other places. The replacing element was added via the motion to amend. So there actually was no dispute about whether or not those disclosed the dropout embodiment or the multi-track embodiment or any of that, because those were not involved in the claim at all. And the other point I want to make is Mr. Greenspoon just talked about the board not making findings, and he's mixing two things here. So there's two components of the claim. There's one thing that happens outside of the local audio device. That's the master time code generator, and the board did find that that was disclosed by Wu, not Strub. The other element, which is the element inside the local audio device, the thing that Zaxcom says is praised, that's the local time code generator. And it is not disputed that that is disclosed by Strub. So all of the elements of the local audio device, the thing that Zaxcom says was praised, were all within the primary reference, except for the audio input port, which they don't dispute with obvious. With that,
thank you. Thank you, Mr. Bell. We appreciate the arguments in both cases, and they're both submitted.